So tonight I want to talk about a few things. And as always, if while I'm talking I do it right, we will end up with you having heard nothing that you don't already know, if I do it right. Because ideally, the way I view what it is that I have to share, it's less about pouring new information into you than trying to fulfill the role of reminding ourselves of something that we already know at the deepest levels of our being, but somehow we have managed to forget. So tonight is probably more specifically pointed in that direction, talking about this idea of reversing the flow. And by the flow, we'll get into what that flow is that we're talking about. Probably I'd like to share a quote with you. I ran across it a couple of years ago. I have this habit that I have cultivated over about the last maybe 25 or 30 years. Just like you all, every now and then you'll hear some choice thing that moves you in some way. For me, I run across things that are profoundly spiritual, things that are, you know, exceedingly witty, just a host of things. I mean, one thing, for instance, years ago when you were allowed to have billboards that advertised cigarettes, Virginia Slims was a brand, and they had one that said, "Be yourself. It's a tough act to follow." You know, so something like that. I saw that. I said, that's good. Makes no difference that they're advertising cigarettes. That one is good. And that one went into my little book. There was a fellow he's a profound teacher. He had one that's not so much of the witty type, but talking about this capacity we have and this habit we have cultivated of judging one another. So his quote was, "A judgment is a tragic expression of an unmet need." So that's one, goes in the book. You know? I found myself in France once, me and my wife, Lillian, you know, overhearing a conversation. This one had to be written down. I mean, the fellow says, "God is dead. Freud is dead. Karl Marx is dead. And I'm not feeling so well myself." You know, he had a very high opinion of himself. So you know that one went in the book. But the one I'm going to share with you, I was at a friend's office some years ago, and she had run across this particular quotation, and it was so profound to her, she had it done in calligraphy, and she had it hanging over her desk. I looked at it, and I said, let me write that down. It was attributed to Nelson Mandela. The way the quote went, it turns out that it was actually Marion Williamson, the contemporary spiritual teacher, who said it, but it was repeated again in a speech by Nelson Mandela, so he got credit for that over her desk. But the way the saying went was this: our worst fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we may be powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that frightens us. So that's one of those ones that I think probably we need to spend just at least a little bit of time with. The idea that it is, in fact, the greatness which we somehow might perceive is lurking somewhere within us that causes us fear. It's an idea that's not strictly logical in the sense that generally, you know, our normal idea is that we want the best, we want it all. But somehow this expression that somehow there is something that is profound, deep, powerful beyond any possible measure is a source of fear to us, and we recoil. You know, the old idea of hiding our light under a basket is what this one speaks to. So, you know, how does something like that work? Around the world, in every spiritual tradition, oftentimes those of you who have heard me speak before know that I'm very much attracted to stories. And you find that there are teaching stories and wisdom stories in traditions around the world. And there's many themes that pop up no matter where you are. But there's this one story you can run across, told perhaps in slightly different ways. Basic idea being that the son of a great man, even a king, somehow became separated from his father at birth and went someplace else, grew up in some place that was not the kingdom, but in humble circumstances, grew up as a poor person. Somehow or another, they find themselves coming back to the court of the king, working as a servant. And then, somehow or another, it is discovered that, in fact, this lowly servant who has lived a life as a poor person is the son of the king. And from that point, the son becomes the prince and is treated like the prince. And he's taken and he has his princely quarters. But in the mind of the son, who is recently rescued from poverty, this whole situation is a little bit unbelievable. And so you find him taking pieces of silverware and hiding it. It's his silverware. It's his kingdom. You know, candlesticks made of gold, stuffing them away in his closet, because his association, his entire life, his entire understanding up to that point confirms something to him, which the confirmation is that somehow or another he is of a lowly status, and this little mirage that's happening at the moment will surely end. This bubble's going to burst. And so that's the storyline. And when we've heard it, it's kind of an interesting story, but most of these stories are not, they're good things to tell to our kids, but the deeper intent of those people who originally told those stories was to communicate something about the inner life. And so this idea that somehow or another, each and every one of us has this innate royalty of spirit that is within us, but that it frightens us, and we don't believe it. And so you ask yourself, how is it that we arrive at such a point as this? And again, you know, probably it would be helpful for me. A lot of these things become much more clear if we put the small piece into the big perspective. I think what often happens with us is that we find ourselves looking at what we can see, and because what we see is so little, we diminish the universe accordingly. So one of the thoughts that you find, which is one of these fundamental ideas that we need to grasp, if we're ever going to really come to some sort of understanding of this wisdom tradition that theosophy is a part of, is the idea that in nature there are cycles that occur. I mean, we all know that. Every day we wake up, every day we go to sleep. You know, on whatever day it is that we came into this world, when it gets back to that day again, we celebrate happy birthday. You know, there are these cycles, seasonal, many sorts of cycles that we are aware of. But also, from this ageless wisdom perspective, there are grander cycles than this. I mean, you take, for example, what we call a year. 365 days is the time that it takes for the Earth to reach, go from one point, travel around the sun, and arrive back at that same point. And that's what we call a year. The solar system within which we live is, you know, one of countless solar systems in this galaxy, the Milky Way. We're sort of out on one of the outer wings, the outer arms of the galaxy. It too circles the center of the galaxy. Now, a galactic year takes a little bit longer than our year. So for this solar system to go around, to cycle around that center, is a period of 200 to 250 million years. That's 1 year in terms of the solar system, a grander cycle. So those are just the observable sorts of cycles that are obvious to us. In the ageless wisdom tradition, they talk about cycles of the outbreathing and the inbreathing of universes, that they appear, they have their lifespan, and they disappear much the same way, you know, that this body does. So very grand cycles. But the cycle that perhaps is most important to us is this cycle that is often described as the cycle of necessity or the obligatory pilgrimage of the soul. The idea behind it is simply that every human being, every individual, is the expression of a couple of different things. One of which is a spiritual soul that comes from afar and associates itself with a body. So there is this obligatory pilgrimage of the soul where it goes from a state of pure spirituality. You know, again, we find this story stepped down for our understanding in the Bibles of the world, where they have stories such as the prodigal son. You know, that's the one that we're most familiar with in the West, where the son leaves the house of the father. You know, the spiritual soul leaves the state of oneness and travels to the distant land where it, basically, it travels to the point where the spirit becomes incarnate in matter and becomes quite forgetful of its heritage. This is the cycle. So, you know, in a sense, it goes from unconscious union with the divine to unconscious association with matter to the next point, which is the one that's the most important one for us, which is to say it goes to the point of the beginnings of self-awareness, the beginnings of self-consciousness. So that's the point where we find ourselves, that basically we are aware that there is a higher potential within us, but we have become so familiarized with this state of impoverishment that we fail to recognize, and we fight against the recognition that is trying to dawn within us. So this idea of reversing the flow, the particular flow that we have found ourselves in, has been this current that has moved us into this world of being associated with this material body, becoming completely convinced that this is, in fact, our reality, and then living in that way. This is something we have a profound conviction that at the deepest levels, we are somehow separate from one another and separate from everything else in nature. We are isolated, we are independent, And every act that we engage in this world seems to give further confirmation to that idea. I mean, if I eat a meal, I get full, I become comfortable, but it doesn't do anything for you. You know, you're just as hungry as you might have been. If I go to the movie, watch what was happening, enjoy the scene, see the movie, you didn't see it. You know, so every single thing that we do seems to confirm this essential state of being separated from one another. I used to use the example, past president of the International Theosophical Society once used this example, that one of the reasons we are so convinced of our separation is that if I tell my hand to move, it moves. If I tell your hand to move, nothing happens. And to me, I said, oh, that's pretty convincing. You know, that makes sense. But let me tell you what happened to me the other day. I saw this with my own eyes. There's a gentleman who feels that neurophysics, you know, the science of brain, the nervous structure and the functioning of the brain, which is becoming quite the hot topic these days, needs to be taught in schools. He says the real problem with it is, though, that the equipment in order to do that is so expensive that you can't do it. So he had a little simple device. And what it was, he hooked it onto anybody come up out of the audience. They came up. He hooked it onto this lady's arm. And he said, okay, I want you to do this. I want you to move your hand like this. And when she did, he had an iPad. And you could look at the iPad, and you could see, like, the waves as she was moving her arm. When she stopped, there was nothing. When she moved, it was something. That was impressive. But then he said, well, let's do this. Could we have another volunteer? So somebody else comes up out of the crowd. He says, look, I'm going to plug this into, there's a jack that connected it to her arm. He said, I'm going to plug it in there, and then let's put it on your arm. We'll put it right here, because there's certain nerves that flow through there. He said, okay, relax your hand. And he told the lady, he said, okay, now move your arm. And when she moved her arm, at first his hand jerked. And then he said, no, just relax a little bit. And then after about two or three times, every time she did that, completely involuntary to the other person, his arm did that. So I said, in one level, I'm going to have to stop using that example. But on another level, it's also sort of a confirmation of the untruth of this idea that we have developed for ourselves. So we're faced with something of a difficulty in that we have become convinced of this essential state of being separate. And the reason we are convinced is because our senses continually give us this report. The problem really lies in this, and it's something that we know, but we can't do a whole lot about. To a certain degree, our experience of reality is constrained by biology, which is to say, our senses, sight, touch, smell, hearing, are severely limited. Just in terms of the electromagnetic spectrum, visible light is one bandwidth within that spectrum. But that spectrum stretches over a large, large area. Everything from low radio waves to gamma waves and everything in between. So the percentage of that spectrum that we are capable of perceiving, the number I heard the other day is 1/10 trillionth of this spectrum is what we perceive the visible light band and the areas of touch. 1/10 trillionth. There are insects that can see ultraviolet light. We can't. Reptiles. We have no possibility of that. Right now, as we sit here, there are thousands of cell phone calls passing through our bodies. I mean, as we sit here, they're not for you, so your phone's not ringing. Plus, you listen to John. You turn the phone off. But thousands of these things are passing through us, and we have no awareness whatsoever because the band that we can perceive is just this tiny little slice. There's a, you know, in the world of crime detection, one of the greatest, there is someone who tracked down and put away more criminals than any other single officer that was functioning in any of the police forces. More than 600 people were put away during the course of this, during the course of their service. I forget the exact name of who it was, but it wasn't a person, it was a bloodhound, a dog. You know, so whenever somebody would do something, they'd call out Fido, and he would track them down. And he would track them down because the sensory perception of the bloodhound is focused in the nose. Millions of these active cells that can scent, to the point that if you had a bloodhound here with you, he'd probably be looking at us and saying, how dense are these people? You know, can't he smell, you know, that 6 days ago, his neighbor was standing right here? Doesn't this dullard know that 100 yards from here, there's a coyote in the bush? Because their sense of smell is the way in which they perceive the world, and it far exceeds anything we are capable of becoming aware of. And yet, for the bloodhound, just like for us, we feel as if we're seeing the real thing, that we're seeing it in its totality, and that we're seeing it correctly. I mean, this is, and the problem too is none of us have imagination enough to be able to sense what it is that we're missing. We can't do it. So we find ourselves stuck in this little band, further convincing ourselves that, the way St. Paul gave a description of this flow that he was trying to reverse. Now, St. Paul was, by anyone's standard, a great man, a realized sort of spiritual being. And what one of the things that he said is, the good that I would do, I don't do. The evil that I don't want to do, I always find myself doing. And it's part of this flow that we are caught up in. This is the condition that we find ourselves in. On another level, though, we're also all aware that yes, we have these five senses, and yes, our general pattern is to find ourselves bound and believing in their reporting. But we also are aware that there are higher senses that we all have access to. And more than one. So we speak, everybody is quite familiar with psychic phenomena. So every person in the room has had the experience of being at home, thinking about some friend they haven't thought about in who knows how long, and the phone rings in minutes. That sort of precognition of events is normal. There's a book that was written by Rupert Sheldrake. He's a scientist, but he's also a member of the Theosophical Society. But he wrote a book about dogs who are aware when their owners are returning home. I think that's even the title. It's a horrible title, but it's a good book. but it explores, you know, the world of a particular sort of phenomena of precognition. All of us have had that. And then we're also aware of people who are perhaps more developed in terms of their sensitivities. And so they can become aware of things that they did not personally experience, but the field of their awareness is perhaps a little bit larger on a certain level. So that's something that we're very much aware of. It's common, it's well known, it's tested, it's not something that's even in doubt. So that's an extension of our potentials. And always when we talk about extension, it involves expanding beyond this kind of isolated center that we have cultivated. So that's one of these different senses that we have. But when we think in terms of spiritual senses, when we think in terms of that avenue we have to perceive some sort of profound connection to a unity, that in somehow there is the possibility of becoming aware that we are intimately linked with all of life, there is a sense that responds and perceives at that level, but it's one that tends to be most deeply hidden from us, always active, but generally hidden. In the term that tends to be used to describe that is the spiritual intuition. The technical name would be buddhi, which is really a plane of awareness. It's the plane of awareness that is capable of perceiving oneness, unity, brotherliness, wholeness, all of those things. And it's a normal aspect of our way of seeing. It's not a hunch or a gut feeling. That's not what we mean when we have this term intuition. It's something much more specific. An example that might describe its functioning. The example that's sometimes given is, if we were to turn the lights out in this room, you know, assuming we had just come in here and we hadn't seen anything, the way we would acquaint ourselves to the room would be by going around in the dark, feeling shapes, you know, trying to put that into some sort of recognition of where it is, what the shape is like, basically groping in the dark. But when we imagine that you turn the light on, when the light comes on, immediately what we perceive is the nature of the totality, the relationships that exist within it. It's a completely different order of vision. This is the example that is often given for the function of this higher sense of intuition. And it is the one that confirms to us this power beyond measure with which we are continually connected. So, you know, how would it be then? You know, how can we go about the cultivation of this particular deeper, much more inclusive sense that is within us? And really, this is, you know, when we talk about the spiritual life, this is really the beginning point for anything that has the name of spirituality. Anything that involves linking ourselves in consciousness with a greater life begins with this spiritual intuition. So what do we do about that? Probably the most important thing, we have certain powers that we are continually using, but in a fashion that we're really not that aware. One of those is the power of our attention, probably the most potent tool that we have. How it is that we use it, where it is that we place it, will determine what to us is real, what we see, what we don't see. From time to time, I've used an example in terms of becoming aware of this intuitive voice that's continually operating within us. The example being, if we were to be at a party of some sort, the music's playing, the glasses are tinkling, the conversations are going, and over in the corner of the room, there is a very wise woman out of the center, back in the corner, whispering. Wherever you find yourself in the room, you're not going to hear a word that she says. You're not going to know a thing about it. But she's saying something continually that we need to, that we want to hear. So how do you do that? You know, how do you come under, how do you expose yourself to that continual whispering? Basically, you place yourself near to it. You walk over, you bend down, you listen, and you hear. And then you go back to the party. You hear, you take what you've heard, go back, utilize it, and then come back again. You know, this is the way this functions. So it begins with the use of our attention. Generally, at any given moment, we find our attention caught up in a host of different stories. You know, during the course of our day, there's things that somebody did to us that we didn't like. There's a food that we tasted that we did. There's an appointment that we have that we must rush to. So our attention is continually being divided and continually being focused on things that can keep pulling us out. Always out. So we have the capacity to choose. I mean, this is an important power, the power to choose. So we can choose what we will place this attention on. One of the greatest ways to really begin to become aware is very simple. You can begin by slowing down. Choose to slow down. The other day I was in downtown Chicago, and you know, it was right during the rush hour time. I was walking on the street, and if you've ever been to Chicago, you know it's a place that moves very fast. And you find yourself moving at the same speed. And without even thinking about it, I found myself caught up in this current. And then I remembered and slowed down. I didn't slow down to the point where I was blocking traffic, you know, or where cars had to dodge me as I'm past crossing the street, but slightly, only so much as so that you know, you slow down. And in that process, you reclaim your misplaced attention. Nothing changes as far as anything that anyone else sees, but for you, the change is dramatic and the change is instant. So this is just one simple thing that we can do with our attention. We have tools that we can utilize to focus this attention and to bring ourselves near to this continual whispering of this intuitive voice. There's nothing that we have to develop. I mean, it's almost as if we said, how do we develop our intuitive capacity? There's nothing to be developed. It's almost exactly like the light from the sun. If we want to be, you know, if you want to get a tan, if you want to be benefited by the light from the sun, you don't have to make more powerful sunlight. You don't have to alter the rays of the sun. What you have to do is figure out a way to remove the barriers that block you from this shining of the light. It's really pretty simple. To identify what they are first, and then to remove them. So with the sun, it's easy. You know, if you're standing inside, the barrier is these walls, or the barrier is these curtains. That you recognize, that you do something about. When we're talking about our inner life, the barriers are similar. The barriers is this most recent thought that I find myself unable to let go of. The barrier is the movement that I've accustomed myself to with this body. I mean, I know countless people who will sit down in a chair without even knowing it. You'll see, you know, just their leg will just be going. And if you were to say, do you know that your leg is moving? They'd be completely unaware. So the tool that you have available continually, it begins with this body and the awareness of it. Probably the most low-tech device for the elevation of consciousness is something that is so mundane that it's completely overlooked. Every one of us, every second, we're breathing. Ordinarily, how aware are you of your breath? Not too often. It's a process that all it takes is just pay attention to it, mild attention to it. You will find that immediately when you start to pay attention to the breath, one of the things that happens is it tends to get a little bit deeper without you forcing it, and it tends to become more regular, less shallow perhaps. But that's one of the problems. And you also find that the moment you start to place your attention on the breath, you find yourself becoming more present. It's a very, very simple and very powerful tool. You know, it does, all of these things are not, you don't require advanced workshops in the variety of spiritual techniques. They're here every moment. And everyone can avail themselves of that. For some, the awareness of this deeper potential is something that becomes really all important in their lives. That really, until we find ourselves living from that perspective, life is somehow, it's got some shadows in it. We find that it's something that might be the feeling of an incompleteness. And so for that sort of person, then there's a level of vigilance that is required, really. Because the idea is that at every given moment, it is possible for us to be available to this intuitive perception, to this sense that we feel as expansion, that we are in some way connected to a much grander life that somehow is living through us, is living as us, when we allow for it. And this is another level of possibility. But the idea that I'm putting forward is this. First, we begin by recognizing this flow that we are caught up in, this flow that pushes us into unawareness, this flow that pushes us into the conviction that the way it is that we live a life is by living from the sense that we're separate from one another. You know, the old idea of survival of the fittest is the rule of the natural world. So long as we're in that sort of mentality, then this deeper potential is unavailable to us. actually, when you look, you know, survival of the fittest, that applies at the level of the animal world. But when you start to look at those people that we would describe as elevated beings, and those, you know, I'm not talking about just the Jesuses or the Buddhas of the world. I'm talking about the people that we have seen who we can say they get it. They're connected to something that I would like to know. Instead of survival of the fittest, you find that in many ways their work revolves around survival of the weakest. That the weakest among us are the ones to whom they turn their focus, that they provide their protection. And you know, we're not too far away from that. Anyone who is a mother, you know, you hear stories about mothers attacking tigers if the tiger threatens the baby. You know, the baby is weak. The weakest among us is the one that causes our growth. People who have mental illnesses, you know, all those sorts of things are the weakest among us. And the sign of greatness is that all beings are embraced. And this is what we point ourselves toward. To a certain degree, it's a matter of practice. You know, we have to accustom ourselves to withdrawing our attention from its captivation in the various stories, to pointing it towards the breath, the sense of expansion we feel, a perception of the space around us, anything that brings us to a sense of presence. Initially, that's something that takes great effort. Great effort, because we have become so habituated to living in another way. But it takes stupendous effort to ultimately become effortless. And that's where it moves toward. You know, that it becomes the set point, you know, for our living. But initially, it requires this great vigilance. So, probably that's what I would, that's probably what I needed to say this evening, that there is this flow. When we recognize it, only then do we have the option of reversing it. The example I would give is if you were to take an arrow and launch it straight up into the air. In its initial flight outward, there's very little you can do to alter the course of that arrow. It's going. But a point comes where its upward path starts to slow. So a point comes where we have been so deeply involved in this material world, in this way of thinking, in this system of beliefs, but the force behind that movement starts to slow. It can continue to go on until it naturally turns, but once it starts to slow is the point where we have an option. This is the point where we can hasten this process, hasten this cycle. And so this is the point where we find ourselves, otherwise this sort of talk would be meaningless. So that's what I would encourage. Utilize the tools we have available, discover more, be vigilant, and persist. Because always you start to see the results.
The way you use the term flow is a little bit surprising to me, because I'm used to thinking of flow as kind of the Tao that you want to get aligned with and flow with. Mm-hmm. And your concept of reversing the flow, I think you're using the word in a different way.
Actually, I'm using the word in the same way, in the sense that just like in the ocean, there are currents that are moving, but they're moving in different directions. You place yourself in one, and it will take you to one place. You place yourself in another, and it will take you to a different destination. I think generally the way the term tends to be used, contemporary spiritual talk, would be, you know, the flow, which is only upward, only toward the divine. But I think we're very well aware. The reason why I tried to take time was to sketch out this idea that there are other currents that we also find ourselves interacting with. The important point to me always is that when we are aware, we do have choices. That simultaneously with the flowing of this one current, there is a current that flows in a very different direction. And we can opt to place ourselves into that. So that's the idea.
Thank you. It's more of a comment on what you said than a question.
Sure.
That, you know, the world has a lot of stuff coming at us, as you mentioned. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, fixing yourself and, mm-hmm. you know, if something's wrong. And then, of course, the world tells you that there's something wrong. But what I like that you brought forward is that it's so simple. It's within ourselves. And anybody can do it. It, you know, it doesn't cost money. It just takes our time mm-hmm. and our conscious awareness. So yeah. At the very basic concept of what you said tonight, I just thought that's what struck me as yeah. being the true message. So thank you.
Yeah, sure. I think it's important to recognize anybody can do it, but nobody can do it until they become aware. In the absence of that, you know, you can sit and cross your legs and say Om, but nothing happens.
I was going to say, sometimes I get into a flow, and I'm very aware of it, but I can't really get out of it. And I know it's not the best place to be. I know it's very constrictive. It's almost like a little, like an eddy or something. I just mm-hmm. keep going around and around. And what's the advice for even what, I know there's something else. I know there's a bigger current right outside there, but I just can't seem to move yeah. myself into it.
Often we can find ourselves swept up in all kinds of different things, whether it's thoughts or whether it's emotional currents. You know, very often, you know, when people experience some sort of blow or some sort of crisis or some sort of loss, the ordinary and the natural response is to, you know, perhaps grieve if it's a loss of a person or even loss of a job. And so we get caught into that emotional world, which is not necessarily, I mean, it's not a bad thing. The problem is only when we cease to be aware. All of us find ourselves living in bodies, all of us. And just by virtue of the fact that we're in this body, certain things are going on. One of them is that from time to time, it gets sick. You know, I don't care how many carrots you eat, it's going to get sick at some point. And you'll feel bad. And when you feel bad, there's nothing wrong with feeling bad. But one of the ideas that I think has some power to it is that when we do find ourselves in those conditions, again, the awareness, the recognition that this passes, you know, that all of these things, whether it's good, whether it's bad, ultimately it comes, ultimately it goes. But that state that abides in the midst of this coming, in the midst of this going, is what we are continually trying to recognize. And that's something that's there whether we're sick, whether we're grieving, whether we're elated with happiness. Always, that's sort of the underlying foundation of all of this. So to the extent that we ever have the experience of rooting ourselves in that, even for a moment, it's never forgotten. And so that's always a touchstone that we have. So we're never completely lost in these things.
Tim, you mentioned at the beginning of your talk about a fear of higher awareness. And do you think that's because people might think they might fail at achieving it, so why try? Or do they fear it doesn't even exist, so why try?
Yeah. I mean, it's probably some of both. But I think it's also that if we were to ever buy into it, you know, if we were to buy into the idea that we are in somehow great beyond measure, it would necessarily require significant changes in our normal behavior. And that's something that we resist. You know, we resist that. I know people who go to the doctor and they say, look, you know, if you don't stop this particular habit, you're going to be very sick. You know, you've got to stop smoking. And they can't do it. I had a good friend who died of cancer, by the way, who smoked cigarettes. He's a deeply spiritual man. And he said, look, we would get on him, say, look, you know you shouldn't be smoking. He said, look, I've given up so many things. I am not giving up my cigarettes. In fact, when I die, put a pack in my coffin so I can light up when I get over there. So, but he lived a very fulfilled life. He died of cancer. But these sorts of, if these things are true about our deep inner nature, then for us to be behaving in the ways that we do, which is to say, feeling as if we're living in this world in conflict with others, you know, feeling as if the role of things is to attract and amass for ourselves, if that's the pattern we have set up, then those are the very things that have to change. And not too many people are up to the change. You know, they've heard this message over and over again. But that I think we resist certain sorts of changes. And then there's this idea of the, you know, people tend to use the word the ego, which controls. You know, there is this overriding sort of a mental habit forms that we have developed that condition our behavior and that relinquish that control are very hesitant about relinquishing its control. So these are patterns that we end up having to break. It's almost as if, you know, we talk about the ego and we talk about these patterns, but they have become so cultivated that it's almost as if it's a separate life form that finds itself attached to us. But it's something that we have created. And in many ways, it takes on a life of its own that directs our finer efforts. In the Bible, they have, you know, all of these different spiritual traditions are symbolic very often. And at the time that in the biblical story about the birth of the Christ, the birth of the Christ consciousness, the emperor, Herod, heard about that someone was born who was said to be, he would be the king of the Jews, which Herod was. And the emperor, which is this reigning sort of lower mind, what he said was, look, I know what I'm going to do about this. Find every firstborn child and kill him. So every firstborn effort to alter our behavior in the direction of the cultivation of this higher consciousness, this one who has ruled for so long, kill it off. Kill this effort. I'm going to change my diet because I think it's something that's more harmless to other creatures. Stop that. I'm going to go out here and help others. I'm going to sit and meditate every day. Don't you know you've got things you have to do? Did you call Mary? All of those things start to get in the way. And it's, you know, it's really a very clear depiction of the way these things operate. Yeah. So that's why it takes a certain dedication But often that dedication has to be born out of an experience that there is, in fact, something more profound that's within us. So in a way, it's for a while, it's a vicious cycle. But then once we actually see something, experience something, then it becomes this virtuous cycle, you know, where good feeds good, increases capacity for goodness, rather than the other way around.
How does this relate to mindfulness?
Oh, really, it's the same thing. Yeah, to the extent that we are not mindful, that we are not aware, you know, of the various levels that we function on. The easiest one to focus on often is the body, you know, to feel what the body feels. You know, I know people who walk around and someone will have to tell them that they have, a sore on their leg or something, because they don't pay attention, they're not aware. But more subtle things too, because we have constantly surging feelings and emotions. Very often we don't have any sort of connection with that. And you know, other people will see that we're out of sorts, but we don't get it. And then our thoughts. You know, these are the main areas where we have that are so active and we are not mindful of. To the extent that we become mindful, just by turning our attention toward them, they quiet, if we engage in it long enough. And then that allows this experience of this deeper sense, this intuitive sense. Yeah. So mindfulness is critically important.
Early in what you said, you referred to the cycles of solar system and the galaxy, mm-hmm. and an idea that I find myself returning to is the vastness of time and, mm-hmm. and of space, mm-hmm. and it seems like on a certain level we're like biologically handicapped from fully appreciating those kind of truly awesome ideas. But I think I return to it because it seems like there's food for spiritual growth there, that trying to think of what's going on at the leading edge of the Big Bang, I guess my question is, what spiritual value does those kind of contemplations have?
Yeah. If we stick with just pure biology, then yes, we're handicapped. You know, biologically, the biology is not going to comprehend the vastness of the universe. But because we're more than that, you know, that's just one dimension of our being. As you said, high thoughts that stretch the mind really, if we look at it like stair steps, in a sense, that there is a level of abstract thinking, there's a level of grandeur in our thought that is possible, and we are capable of taking this thought to such a level that it becomes quite refined, that it really starts to border on that which, you know, the next step beyond that is something that moves beyond mere thought. And so this is one of the yoga systems that is developed. You talk about jnana yoga, the yoga of knowledge, where this cultivation of the mind and this ladder-like approach to thinking ever more and more rarefied thoughts is part of that approach. So any one of the particular vehicles that we inhabit, we can reach this exalted state. Hatha yoga moves toward that. But this is a particular approach where we come to the experience of the divine or the limitless through utilizing the mind and cultivating the mind. Because ultimately what happens, if we think long enough and if we think deep enough about vast sorts of thoughts, it reaches a point where the mind no longer has the capacity to reach, to grab, to pull anything else in, and it becomes still. You know, the mind, in a sense, exceeds itself. And at that point, if we have engaged in this practice and are capable of sitting still, it's at that point that deeper realizations, this intuitive shining that I was talking about, where the light of the intuition shines upon the still surface of the mind. And at that point, you know, these are the sorts of things where people like Einstein and others had profound scientific revelations. So it's a genuine practice, that particular avenue. It's interesting, too, because, you know, one of the things that tends to be, if you're a scientist today, and if you want to be a working scientist, you had better not be studying consciousness, because it's regarded as sort of pseudoscientific and all that. And yet you look at the great breakthroughs in science that have occurred through dreams, through visions. Albert Einstein, he made no bones about it. He had a dream when he was a man about 20 years old of riding on a sled. And he was going on a sled down a hill. And as he was going, the sled just kept picking up speed until he felt like it reached the speed of light. And he said, as it reached this very fast speed, he looked up at the stars. And he said, the stars were giving a light, were refracting light in a way that he had never seen. And he said that his entire scientific career was a meditation on that dream. And he's not the only one. So, you know, consciousness is what is primary, what is preeminent. And there are a variety of ways that we're able to experience it. And so the important part for each one of us is to find that way that works for our temperament.
Does awareness give way to knowing, or does knowing give way to awareness?
Somebody planted you in the audience to, to utterly confuse me. Does awareness give way to knowing, or does knowing give way to awareness? You know, oftentimes I find myself, I have a little bit of a problem with knowing, the word knowing, in the sense that it has a wide range of meanings. I think when we are aware, certainly certain things we become, we know. You know, we know the movement of the breath when we're aware of it. You know, we know the currents that we feel pulsing through the body when we're aware of it. So that becomes a sort of a, one moves into the other. And then in order to focus, in order to become aware, to a certain extent we have to have some sort of resident knowledge that it's possible even. You know, it's the times that we are often most keenly aware, oftentimes when we find ourselves in strange circumstances or in even in danger. Now, if you think about it, if you wake up in the middle of the night and you hear some unusual sound in your home, there is that, you know, your ear becomes so heightened, and your hearing becomes so high, and every little, you can hear a bug crawling across the floor when you're in that heightened state. It's not a function of any sort of conscious knowledge. It's, at that point, it is the reflex. To a certain degree, we utilize knowledge in order to cultivate this sort of reflex within us. So the two, it's hard to separate the two. I think that's what makes the That's what makes the question a little bit difficult. Yeah, but it's a good question.
I just wanted to say that you've centered on the mind throughout this whole, but haven't said anything about love and the heart. And that I always think of all of this sort of spiritual stuff as being all one. How can you have one without the other?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. Probably I could say that I focused on the mind. It's, to me, and probably I should, this is a good thing because I should not take that for granted. I think very often we have this kind of way of dividing. The mind is something that really is very, it's an all-encompassing instrument. When, you know, the definition of what is a human being is highest spirit, lowest matter, linked by mind. And so you end up with these quotations and scriptural references like, as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. You know, thinking in the heart. You know, ultimately, the heart is the organ of spiritual perception. But even that's not necessarily the physical heart. Just like the mind is certainly not merely the brain. Both of them, their functioning is required in order for this kind of complete comprehension. So, yeah, the heart awareness is something that is central to the spiritual mind. There is no awareness of unity in the absence of love. There is no possible experience of unity in the absence of compassion. That's just, you know, like there is no possibility of coming down to earth without gravity. You know, they're all so intimately interwoven.